of Bruce Wojcik, Toward a Theology of Breakthrough Innovation.
Thanks a lot, Randy. I do want to thank Randy and Bob for the invitation to speak this morning. Before I begin, I set out copies of a handout. Does anybody not have a copy? Because I spread them out in a uniform distribution, and since we never sit in uniform distribution. So there are extra ones here on the side and some other ones, so I tried to spread them out enough. If anybody wants another one, please feel free to grab one, but at least you'll have it. And it includes the outline for the presentation. The insert is some of my working notes, if you will. So you're welcome to follow the outline or not. There's also some other material as well in there that I'll at least refer to in the outline and perhaps in the talk. I did have a leg up on Randy. I first met Randy about 2 months after I joined the university. He received an alumni award at the college level, and in his bio sketch, it included that he was an alum from Wheaton College, and I had lived six blocks from Wheaton College, and I figured that that probably told me something. So, and my interactions afterwards bore that out as well. So I maybe should have initiated discussion earlier with you, Randy, but yeah. The talk will really have three sections. I'm going to spend just a few minutes to provide some introductory context remarks to help you frame, to understand where I'm coming from and maybe some of the ideas that I'll be talking about. But the three parts are a discussion of research results on serial innovators, on people who've been responsible for breakthrough innovation in large, mature firms, some observations that I've had on how people come to know what to do today in order to have impact tomorrow, and that's this epistemology of innovation reflections that I've had. And then finally, over a number of years, I've been trying to reconcile my faith with what I've observed in this line of reflection and thinking, and I'll share some of that. I've got a series of drop-off points, so if it starts getting long, I'll drop off and the notes will be there for you. So with some introductory remarks, I think most of you will be aware of this, but innovation is not something that's just been kind of important in the last several years. If I look back to 50 years ago, to 1963, compared to today, it was really a striking difference in those 50 years. And these are just some examples of product categories. I'll often tell students in my technology management class that in 1973, if you were an engineer or scientist working on handheld calculators, you had to have expertise in wood or the machining of metal because you were designing and building slide rules. And literally within 12 months or 24 months, the whole world had changed. The world had changed from a technology that had been around, identified and invented by Napier hundreds of years before. So innovation is something that's not just current, but innovation is something that also affects literally the lives of individuals. And I can admit to this because I've been with one organization that was shut down and one business organization that was sold. And so I've been on the receiving end of innovation, if you will, and also on the delivering end of it. So the survival of firms are impacted, and really how a lot that goes on in the world plays out. What I like to do is give a little example of what I mean by breakthrough innovation, because what we studied and what I'll talk about is breakthrough innovation. And so I brought some examples. I thought it was kind of interesting for a group of scientists to not have any physical examples that I'd seen so far. So I brought a carrot. And about 100 years ago, if you wanted to peel a carrot, you'd use a knife and you'd peel the carrot. But if you're like me, there'd be a lot of waste and you'd probably cut yourself. Okay. And in fact, about a month and a half ago, I was illustrating this and I literally did cut myself. And I'm not proud of that, but it just shows that this is a real problem. So if you wanted to improve on that, you'd build, something that would be a safety peeler. It'd have blades pointing in away from the person peeling, and you could peel much more quickly and not likely cut yourself. But if you did this all day or had to do it quickly, it'd be a problem. So what you'd do then is you would get an ergonomic peeler with a handle that the original design literally came from somebody sawing off the handle of a broom and attaching it to a peeler, and I could probably do this all day. The problem is if I work in a restaurant and I want to do this quickly, I would have to go find a way to do this with great speed. And so I would rely on some engineer or maybe scientist to design something that would look like this. And what I would do, if I did it right, here, see if I can line this up. I could peel carrots. If I was better at it, I could do this more quickly. but I could peel a whole carrot at once with, you know, minimal waste, you know. But what happens is this gets really expensive. So if I really wanted peeled carrots and I wanted to innovate, what I would do is I would just buy a bag of peeled carrots, okay? So thank you. I wish I could accept this as mine, but it's not. I saw the peeled carrot example from someone else, and to me it's a marvelous example of breakthrough innovation. Everything else is somewhat incremental. This is really breakthrough. This is really rethinking the problem. And we saw examples of this throughout a number of talks. I'll say that the talk that we saw yesterday on the plenary talk yesterday, to me, showed a reframing of the problem, a rethinking of how we define the problem. And we saw it in other cases as well. The Saturday night presentation, Dr. Ming Wang reframed the problem. He took a dichotomy and dilemma and he reframed the problem. And so in a way, he did the bag of peeled carrot solution. If you look at a company, you look at innovation, there are these generally two types. This is a spectrum of generally two types. Incremental innovation, like designing a safety peeler, is pretty easy and it's pretty likely to succeed. And it delivers a return financially, but not a great amount. Compared to breakthrough, this is something that not everybody would think about. The likelihood of success could have been quite low, but in the end, it returned a lot of money because not only did it give you something the customers wanted, it also gave you something that could use scrap carrots that you couldn't have used otherwise. Innovation's not limited to business. I love this chart. I wish it was mine. If you look at high jump gold medal heights in the last 100 plus years, it follows this pattern. What you don't know, though, until you start to think about it, is that there are a series of paradigms that were used that allowed this innovation to occur. So a jump between the straddle jump and the Fosbury flop represented a breakthrough, an entirely different way of doing things, but within each one of those, there was incremental innovation. And in fact, moving to the Fosbury flop only could occur because of a related enabling technology change, and that's moving from jumping into a sawdust pit to jumping into a foam pad. You'd break your neck if you jump backwards into a sawdust pit. Innovation's not limited to the present. This is Albrecht Dürer. Written up in The Economist about a year and a half, 2 years ago. If you look at the state of woodcutting right before Dürer, they were kind of stiff and unsophisticated, and they didn't have a good feeling for how to couple the lines that would describe the images as well as to shade them. Dürer broke through that, but he not only broke through in terms of how he drew, he also had a different business plan than the previous people. They would build and design their woodcuts based on being paid for on commission by very wealthy clients. Dürer speculatively printed woodcuts and sold, if you will, in the open market. And as a result, he had a different, much broader impact, and he also wasn't constrained by what he included in his images. I'm sorry, I'm getting dry. If there's any water here, I'll beg for it. If not, that's fine. I'll keep going, but if there's even just a drop, and I should have thought, I apologize. If I talk a bit about how I got to where I'm at, as Randy said, an Illinois background in engineering, the way I've color-coded this or shaded this, the dark is technology. Moving to the right is moving away from technology. The gray area is more my business experience. And then finally, in the last several years, I've been studying very much on a part-time basis at Urbana Seminary. I want to thank, in particular, Ken Cuffey and Todd Daly from the seminary. I have the equivalent, thanks a million, I owe you. Thank you, the people at the seminary, because it was with them that I was able to study, really for the first time, a comprehensive view of Old and New Testament, introductions and surveys, as well as a three-course sequence in theology that got me thinking more on this topic. And again, as Randy said, I've been in recent years looking more into things like epistemology and theology, but always tethered to the idea of how does it relate to innovation. When I was 31, I came to faith, and so what you'll hear is really a presentation from someone who is trying to make sense of life post-conversion, someone who really had their career moving pretty well before they began to reflect on these things. And so in some people's cases, this may appear somewhat backwards. This has been kind of the way my life has played out. So I thought I'd share that context with you too. My interest, first of all, the interest in innovation. I've been in industry for long enough and seen enough people be successful that I've always wondered how they see it, how they get it. And so even the early work that I did before I got into the epistemology was motivated by me trying to understand how do these people see things that I don't see. And then also, as I just mentioned, how do I reconcile what I see with faith? How do I make sense of this? Is it, I hate to say this, but in the back of my mind there was a sense of, is this okay, almost, going on. So let me talk a bit about the research. This is research done in collaboration with Abby Griffin, who's now at the University of Utah, and Ray Price, who's my colleague still at the University of Illinois. We've spent over a dozen years, and we've studied what we refer to as a people view of innovation. We didn't know at the time when we first started down this path how important that was, but up until then, really what most researchers do when they look at innovation is they look at processes. We didn't look at the process explicitly and try to understand how to optimize it or how the process worked. We looked at the people who were most successful. These are rare, unique individuals. Sometimes there are maybe 10 or 20 people out of a company that maybe has 10,000 engineers and scientists. We've conducted a large number of interviews, and I want to be really clear because this won't come out again. We've talked to people in a large number of industries, and in many, or I won't say most, but well over half the cases, multiple companies from within an industry. So we once had someone tell us, or tell me actually in casual conversation, you know, we knew we had someone like this, what you're describing. We just didn't know that other people had them. We've published widely, and the bottom line is that even though we're looking at these exemplars of innovation, there are implications for everybody. And I'll add, even in response preemptively to the question that Bob asked a few times, I think there are implications of the patterns of how they discover to science as well as to faith. I think there's a lot of the same stuff going on. Our results were published last year in a book published by Stanford Press, Serial Innovators. And let me just spend a few minutes talking about the people before I go into these other areas of epistemology and kind of a reflection on the theology of breakthrough innovation. These are 300 people, or little stick figure people. And does anybody notice anything now in this picture? Yeah, there's one person blinking at you. This is one in 300. When we did a survey of physicists in the U.S. and the U.K., we found that in large mature firms, that anywhere from 1 in 100 to 1 in 600 was roughly the frequency of how often these people appeared. And it's pretty much borne out in the research that we've done when we've interviewed people at these large mature companies. One of the things that we say, though, is that while everybody can be taught to sing, and this is an example of singing, we wouldn't deny it, not everybody's going to be able to star or sing at the Met, okay? So what I'm going to be very clear about is where a lot of people will talk about innovation today and say we've got to raise the temperature of everybody, and I believe we do. I think we have to help everybody. Not everybody is going to be an exemplar. I think it's just the reality of it. And there's a lot of there are a lot of people that don't view things this way. So I want to be clear that this is the case, but I'm also clear that, and I'm not going to show this slide, but there are a lot of people that sing in the Met and the chorus that are incredibly powerful singers, and they play a key role. So in industry, there are a lot of other people that play adjunct roles to these exemplars. I don't want to imply that we're only saying the heroes are valid and we fire everybody else. By no means is that the case. Everything that I talk about is very much what we've observed is breaking down a lot of false dichotomies. And so to give you an example, I've talked a bit, I showed you a bit about carrots, but let me tell a story about a person, because this really is about people. Tom Osborne is a great guy. I count myself fortunate to have met him and known him, or to know him. We presented together at the American Oil Chemists Society annual meeting a few years back. I presented our research, he told the story, and we also tell Tom's story in our book. Tom was a lifelong employee at Procter & Gamble. He retired about 2 years ago. And came to the company with a background, I believe, in chemical physics. And he was hired into a couple of different, he was hired into one area, moved to a couple areas, but he very quickly in his career ended up in the feminine hygiene product area. And at the time, the work on feminine hygiene products was such that They worked within a paradigm, within an understanding of what the product was. And I'm not sure if they articulated explicitly this way, but it was essentially analogous to a diaper, that a feminine hygiene product was there to catch fluid. And so all the engineers were trying to optimize this diaper-like product. And Tom, having a background that was more of a scientist, and I'm not trying to play to the audience, if you will, even though I'm an engineer, he was, I'd say, more of a discoverer. And he was bothered by the fact that that paradigm just didn't seem to be probably as good as it could be. And so he spent a lot of time ruminating, reflecting, doing experiments, bootlegging projects on the side. And what he began to realize, and in fact he worked with medical models, and by that I mean literally people who are hired by physicians in medical schools to be worked on so that the physicians can learn how to work with the human being. Tom hired models to understand how to work with these products. And he began to realize that the paradigm, not unlike the paradigm of peeling carrots by hand, the paradigm of the feminine hygiene product being a diaper was wrong, and you really needed to look at it, again, I don't want to be inappropriate, but you had to look at it very differently, different paradigm. He realized that if you looked at it like a garment, that it would be much more appealing to consumers, and you could still find a way to do it that was still very powerfully fulfilling the other attributes that consumers wanted. Well, he had this idea, he tested it, he bootlegged these projects, he had people on the side making samples, and he almost got fired on two separate occasions. Okay. Organizations become big because there are large markets. If we look at economies of scale and scope, we look back to Adam Smith, there are good reasons why companies get big. Okay, I don't want to knock that. The problem is when companies get big, they tend to put blinders on, and they tend to sometimes lose sight to things that are going to disrupt them. And through a number of different sequences of events, including his colleagues who recognized Tom's value and the value of his ideas, who stood up for him, eventually the management came around. It's a beautiful story. It's a story of the management recognizing and realizing that this guy's onto something. And the product is now the Always Ultra product, and it's one of P&G's billion-dollar brands. And so, and we've heard other stories like this, but this is one that I can share with you. It's a case where you've got a unique individual who understood things intimately and deeply. He saw the problem holistically. He reframed it. He took responsibility and ownership to make it happen. He put his career at risk, if you will. And in the end, it worked. Doesn't always work out, but in this case, it did. When we studied the innovators, we came at this with a number of different approaches. One of the early things we did was we looked at what are their salient features, how are they motivated, what can we learn about personality, their perspective, and their preparation. The one point I want to emphasize in this chart, because it really relates to this talk, is that the best innovators were intrinsically motivated to solve other people's problems. This is not the case, typically, and I'll get into this a bit in more detail later. They really wanted to help other people. While very pragmatic in getting things done, they were also very idealistic in helping others. And I don't mean just customers. They also helped their colleagues, keeping jobs, they helped shareholders, and they served management as well. What we did later, though, is we reframed this, and we said, well, how would we identify and recognize these people? And in a way, it's kind of like recognizing a bird using an Audubon field guide, if you will. But we said, how do they interact with and engage with problems that they're faced with, projects, and how do they interact with business and people? And again, these are curious people. They ask a lot of questions. They think in systems, holistic wholes. They're creative, tenacious. They drive things through to happen. But they understand, too, that they're in business to create a profit. So you can distinguish these from inventors in companies, because inventors typically are going to have a posture of focusing on the science. These people are focused on solving the company's problems. And it's the complete set of characteristics. You can get some of these characteristics, and you'll have a great employee. But really, to be the breakthrough innovators, typically it's the complete set. For those of you who aren't familiar with innovation processes in large, mature companies, they typically flow like this. And in fact, I don't think you can see this. There's a line right here on the chart that I have. I used gray probably a bit too often in my charts. The front end of innovation is kind of like the hypothesis phase of the scientific method. The back end is like the testing phase, if you will. Breakthrough innovation in companies is typically managed in this process. It doesn't play out in this process. It's managed this way. They expect inventors, technical people, to come up with these technical ideas. Usually some person from a marketing background will bridge the front end to the back end, and then engineers who are implementers will carry it through the back end. And if it works, it's successful, and if it doesn't, they throw it out. Okay? It's very much a build a bunch of stuff and see what works. What these people did, though, this is not a process. Even though we call it a process, this is much more of a state diagram. They'd start in the upper left, motivated to innovate. They would spend a lot of time identifying a good problem because it takes as much time to solve a good problem as a bad problem, so why not solve a good one, one that has value to people? They would then go over to the upper right. They would spend time trying to understand that problem deeply. But if they understood the problem deeply and it wasn't a good problem, they'd go back and redefine the problem. If they understood it deeply, they might start to invent and validate in a minute. But again, if they found out that they didn't know enough, they'd go back either to understand more or go back and redefine the problem. The point here is that this is a very nonlinear system with all of the mathematical consequences associated with this, at least qualitatively. It's a nonlinear, not a linear system. Finally, how they navigate the organization. Every one of them started out with what we would refer to, and they often would refer to as kind of a naive view, that my invention, that my science or engineering was sufficient. That it was up to management or someone else to identify the value in this, and that others should act without me taking any effort. That I'm done. I've done the science or engineering. It's up to you. And at times people would get bitter in organizations because they wouldn't see their ideas acted on. The successful ones did what we refer to as crossing the bridge. They accepted responsibility. They used their great skill of scientific discovery to discovering how to interact with others at a political level. And political, we mean this as a positive, not a disruptive or negative. It's how do you interact with others in the organization. They would often work on influence skills. They would very much accept this as their lot in life. And it was almost always outside of their comfort zone. A few cases where it wasn't, but almost always it was something where they had to push themselves a bit. So that's kind of a quick summary overview of our research. I want to spend a few minutes talking now on some observations about how these people have come to know what to do, and then I'll jump into this last section on kind of this path towards a theology of breakthrough innovation. Over probably the last 5 or 6 years, about half the time I've worked on this project, on my own more, I've been exploring how these people understand what to do. And there are a lot of different insights I've had. I've been releasing them slowly in a series of roughly 2-page essays at a website called epistemologyofinnovation.com. It's hyphenated. And I actually included 2 essays in the back of here if you want to read them. The first one of the two I'll refer to later, The Magic Eyes of Innovation. That relates more to this talk. The last one about feral cats and pet cats is the one that I've gotten the most fun feedback on, and I think you'll enjoy it too. But when I look at this over the last several years, and I've kind of stepped back and said, what are the big themes? And I've seen 3 major themes so far. And these 3 themes are not only important individually, they're also important collectively. And the first is that these people, and I began to hint at this, they're holistic thinkers. They talk about things like connecting the dots. Okay, we hear phrases like that. In fact, I often refer to this as kind of their not tacit knowledge, but their explicit nescience. People will use words and not even really realize how important those words and phrases are. They see patterns in data that others do not. They find these new ways to frame problems. I was having lunch with one of them at one point, and she looked up at me and she said, "I see dead people." And I'm like, okay, you know, time out, you know, help me understand this. And if you've seen the movie The Sixth Sense with Bruce Willis, and I hadn't, that was partly why. Bruce, and I won't give away the ending, I had to watch the whole story to figure this out. But Bruce Willis and another character see dead people, and you know, you're trying to wrestle with this. What this innovator was telling me, basically, was that she was able to see patterns that others couldn't, and it actually disturbed her for a while because she's questioning her own abilities. When she grew in confidence, and very confident in the best sense person, as she grew in confidence that this was not only okay, but that it was important, she began to much more advocate for these things, but still behaving in a really powerful way. They're very intimate in the way they think. I've not written this up yet at all, but I began to realize, and I talked about this earlier, about these dead metaphors that people use. The word understand, I didn't know until a couple of years ago that understand, if you look at its etymology, means to stand in the midst of. Apprehend means to grasp. There are a lot of words that, you know, I like old movies, and when I see people in old movies say, hey, you know, capiche, you know, it means to grab or to grasp. We talk about wrapping our mind around a problem. Since this is a scientific group, I can refer to the word grok. I'm sure some of you have read Heinlein. And again, very intimate act, you know. And even ruminating, I told one of my ag engineering friends about how these people ruminate, and I didn't think about it, being that ruminant is, among other things, a cow. I don't need to tell you guys that, I guess, but I was not taken back. But they digest the facts. And so after I learned that, I visited our ag open house one year, and we have what's called a fistula. We have a couple of what are called fistulated cows, which means they cut a hole in the side of them, and with a plastic glove on, I was able to stick my arm into the stomach of a cow. And it's fascinating because they showed me the full-size mock-up of a cow's stomach, and we could talk all day. But until I stuck my hand in there, I didn't know the smell, the texture, and the temperature. And so I learned through this intimate engagement in the cow stuff that I would have never known otherwise. Last, these people are nonlinear thinkers. They see how the elements work together in ways that are beyond mere addition. And this is a hard one for me to know how to articulate. With this group, I think I can do a better job of it, given your background. Not only do other dead metaphors tend to support this view, if you're familiar with patent law, what's not patentable is a simple combination of ideas. Okay? The way I like to look at this is that if you have vectors, if you add two vectors, when you add them, they're still in the same plane defined by the first two vectors. Okay, that's not considered inventive enough to be patentable. When you multiply those two vectors, they propel you into a new dimension. And you know, and I'm going to tell you, I'm going to tell you that factual knowledge, I believe, and I've got this as a publication coming out soon. It's referenced in the book. I think factual information can be at least qualitatively modeled as an orthogonal set. And as this orthogonal set is either added to or multiplied, you see all the behaviors and characteristics of people having, you know, multiple depth in different fields and how that could likely play out as being innovative. So again, these people collectively have these holistic and intimate and nonlinear characteristics. But these characteristics, and this was for me kind of something of a breakthrough, these characteristics really are diametrically opposed to what we thought of as modern thinking. I mean, think about, you know, what do they teach you in introductory physics class when they teach you how to analyze a pendulum, okay? You detach yourself from the pendulum. You don't interact with it. You just observe it. You detach the pendulum and everything else from its surrounding potential environment. There's no wisp of air or anything that could maybe disturb it. You linearize the problem. You take the sine theta and you say, well, we're only going to look at small angles. We reduce it to the pendulum, the object itself, and gravity. And we can, with great success and great impact, I'm not saying this is bad, great impact, we can have huge impact on all sorts of things and how our lives have changed in the last few hundred years by this modern thinking. But yet, the people who do this best, they have this modern thinking. It's their entry ticket. They probably wouldn't have been hired if they didn't, but they also have this breakthrough thinking. I will say that this is, it's important to have both of these, but again, I want to be clear, if they don't interact well with others, if they don't advocate appropriately, it's really not sufficient for success. So where are we? And there's more writing that I've done on epistemology of innovation. I just wanted to hit the highlights relevant to this talk. So where are we, or where was I, when I was in these points, kind of muddling through this? I could say that the Enlightenment paved the way for modernity, and a lot of great progress came of it. And I'm not selling any of these books, but there's a great book here by Joel Moker. He's an economic historian. It's The Gifts of Athena. He talks about how these changes actually led not only to the scientific revolution, but also to the industrial revolution. And I'd say that it's pretty clear to me from what I've seen. But yet, contemporary innovation is characterized by a different way of thinking. And let me point out, and I'll come back to one of these again later, the work of a friend of mine, Esther Meek. She works at Geneva College in the philosophy department. She's an epistemologist. She's written this book called Longing to Know, and I mean this in the best sense. I view this as epistemology for dummies, because I learned so much from reading through this book in my early wrestling with things. She's written a much larger book recently called Loving to Know. But again, she talks a lot about how modernity has reduced us to thinking in certain ways, and there are ways of thinking that we've lost almost as a society. I'm saying that these are people who have not only lost it, there's something of this highly successful remnant, okay? And I use the word remnant again with this group as fellow believers. I don't want to say that they're necessarily living in the past, but they're people who still understand the value of this other way of thinking. But yet, innovation remains unconquered. And I know that's kind of a loaded phrase, unconquered, but it's unpredictable. There are still things that play out in innovation. Despite everybody's best efforts, despite countless books that are written about innovation, I mean, you have no idea how much writing has taken place in all these different tricks and checklists of things that you have to do to be an innovator, but it's elusive, it's unpredictable. And to me, I recognize something in that. I say, okay, it's unpredictable. What might that tell us? And so what I'll then now spend, you know, some amount of time left, I'll stop, I'd say appropriately. I won't go all through the material that's outlined here, but again, the slides will be available. And I tend to use, if you haven't noticed, a lot of slides, so it's pretty readable, I think. So we're stuck. These limitations of modern enlightenment-driven thinking remain. But now let's think about this. What do we know about modernity? And again, from this theology sequence that I took, two more reflective on historical views of theology, one more on contemporary theology. We spent, you know, a fair amount of time, you know, just kind of exploring and discussing modernity. And modernity really is characterized by these simultaneous views of hope and fear. Hope in that we can do it, we can solve the problems. Fear in that we maybe don't yet know enough to solve them. It's kind of a strange tension, the more I've thought about it. And in a way that modernity has among many gospels, it has a gospel of innovation. It has a gospel that says we can trust innovation to solve our problems. If I only get a job in innovation, I'm going to have a lot more fun than somebody else. If only we can innovate how to solve certain problems, we'll save the world. And it kind of goes on and on. Some people carry it to that extreme. Not everybody does. But that gospel of innovation, you know, by definition, will be inconsistent with the gospel of Jesus. I mean, it is trusting in something else at its extreme. And there's also what I refer to as a love of innovation. And I use this title because, to me, this phrase, love of innovation, can have two very different meanings. We can say it once, and we can mean two entirely opposite things and capture at once both the hope, you know, that we have in the gospel of Christ, but also the fear and the despair, if you will come from a gospel of innovation. I think this is one of the last books I'll mention. And a lot of these are referenced in my outline. This book by Craig Gay, called The Way of the Modern World, really had a huge impact on me. It was one of our assigned readings in this theology sequence. But beyond that, I just resonated with really the entire book. And in fact, you'll find a four-page book review that I wrote in the handout. I thought that would be helpful to just give some context about where I'm coming from. But if we look at kind of a nutshell view of what Craig Gay said in this book, and it resolved a lot of problems for me, because what he addressed was the problem of what does it mean to live in but not of the world. And I want to be really clear. I can't say I have a great grasp on it, a perfect grasp on it, but my grasp has really been enhanced by reading this book. But what Gay says is that in the modern world, that the modern world views as if it lives as if, even if God exists, he's really not relevant to what we're doing. And it's not explicitly hostile. And I would say, you know, that view of the world, meaning that God's largely irrelevant, is a hostile view, but it's not explicitly hostile. But it's just kind of this indifferent view. And in modernity, humankind seeks to limit the world and make it predictable. And at some level, some of this is okay. I want to be really clear. There are lines when we cross and it becomes sinful, but I'd say that my take on this, that there are aspects where we should try to make things predictable. But then at times, it actually tries to remake the world, and this can be pretty extreme. To some extent, this view of modernity, Gay argues, is based on the fact the rise of a worldview of kind of a material-only view of the world, and it actually has succeeded a great deal because a lot of the world functions in ways that can be described with mathematical patterns. It works. And not to be pragmatic, I mean, I think it really does, it fits, it's consistent. He also argues that the modern worldview is fragile, and it's exposed really by reality. And, you know, I think it's a powerful way to look at this. So the next few slides I go through quickly because what I did after I talked to Bob and Randy when I was invited for this talk, and I was even doing this before, I have my box of clippings, okay? And I've got this cardboard box, a book-sized box. And, you know, usually I read primarily the Wall Street Journal in terms of non-technical or other things. But I'll clip articles out or I'll save articles from the Chronicle of Higher Ed. And especially over the last, 6 months or year, my box has grown quickly because I've been thinking about modernity and I'm thinking about this talk. So, we all know, about the screen there. There are other images. Modernity is characterized by fear. But at the same time, about a month ago, from the IEEE, I get this Institute magazine, and the whole issue was about improving lives with technology. It's the hope and self-confidence of modernity coupled with the fear. Okay, another one, I don't know, those of you who are familiar with Andy Grove, one of the founders of Intel, wrote a book that the title of Only the Paranoid Survive. Okay, and that kind of, to me, communicates fear. And then Ray Kurzweil, those of you who may be familiar with his thinking about a singularity, these are kind of this extreme level of confidence, maybe not even of self, but confidence in the singularity changing how the world may be seen at some point, putting a lot of faith in that. These are headlines from various articles in the Wall Street Journal. The first one, having been in industry, I could relate to. You can't read it, but it says, this is a quote from a guy that got fired, one of my jobs is to make sure people don't relax, to keep the tension high. And then he goes on to say, I don't mean to hurt people, but everything matters now and we have to be great. Well, I gotta tell you, that's kind of difficult for me. I don't know about you guys, but I think it's great to work hard and everything, but there can be extremes. But every one of these articles is about fear. In fact, one of the articles was a book review about, it was an encyclopedia of paranoia, basically. More in the self-confidence, Steve Jobs, there was a full-page photo of him referring to him as a secular prophet. Shortly after some of the recent shootings, one of the questions is, can data mining stop the killing? Now, again, I realize that when these are written, they're not written necessarily to mean stop it as in permanently, but yet they're written that way. And so I have to just say, what can we take from these things? In fact, after one of the shootings, I heard a commentator, Riley, comment that after a shooting, the first reaction of many people is to commit sociology. And it's kind of an unfortunate view. And again, it's not to knock sociology, but it's an unfortunate view that we're looking to solve these problems in ways that they really can't ultimately be solved. I feel that we have a responsibility to address these things. I think it would be inappropriate to not deal with them, but I also say that we can't trust and count on these things. So what I'm going to talk about in these remaining few minutes that I've got before I leave time for questions, because I go to do that, by appropriate time left. This is a personal theology. It's me reflecting on what's my embedded, unarticulated theology on this. Can I move to one that's maybe more coherent or explicit? So I'm going to talk about two dichotomies. And then as time permits, I would like to at least talk about the innovator's perspective and posture, and I'll probably leave the rest of it for you. So let's first look at the two Gospels. And I mentioned this earlier. In summary, the idea in the Gospel on the left, we'll all be familiar with. The Gospel on the right is the one that I'm looking to contrast it with. If we say that humankind views innovation as something, a source of hope in the face of despair, we often feel that innovation is going to save us from things that either cause us to be fearful, unhappy, or at least unsatisfied. We talk about sin separating us from God. on the gospel of innovation, we're just frustrated, dissatisfied, or maybe, you know, the elements are going to overwhelm us in a hurricane or a flood. New products are the source of salvation in the gospel of innovation. The material is all there is. And humankind holds significant power. And again, the handout that I have, the insert, includes several similar types of comparisons. I thought about how would I visualize this in a way that I might be able to communicate this with others. I think you'll see patterns that you'll find familiar, but what about to those who wouldn't? If we view the kingdom of God as being in this one plane and colored with kind of this purplish haze in terms of knowing, and the kingdom of humanity down below, where the limits of human knowledge are in that cloud. One way to visualize this is to say that, if you will, the kingdom of God is at hand, and they're existing together at once. Now, if you live as if God does not exist, this kind of extreme modern view, what you really have is the kingdom of humanity. Humankind knows everything inside the cloud. Everything else is just yet to be conquered. It's the hope associated with that. If you view God as God of the gaps, we'll take care of the part on the inside, and until we conquer the outside, we'll trust the Lord with that. And then the gospel of Jesus, I say that there really is no boundary. It may not appear in the slide, but in the kingdom of humanity, I include in there, it really is intended to be colored with that same purple shading as the other. I don't want to draw a distinction there. So, his imminent presence with us. So, two loves. And the question really is, who is the innovator loving? And Todd Daly, who I mentioned earlier, the theology faculty member at Urbana Seminary, mentioned this to me as I discussed my presentation with him recently. And he talked about this short work by Bernard of Clairvaux, written in about, I think, 1100. And what Bernard talked about was that there's kind of there are these degrees of love, these levels of love that an individual might go through, starting out with a love of self for self's sake in the lower left. By the way, these are my 2x2 matrices for my talk, so I've got a few others that I might not get to. But you start with very selfish love. Even when you first love God, when you call out to Him for salvation, you're calling out to Him as a Savior. It's a love of self. And then loving God for God's sake, a form of praise. And then ultimately, and I've not yet been able to wrap my mind around this well enough to discuss it in a way that I'm comfortable with yet, but not that I'm uncomfortable with the concept, I'm just uncomfortable discussing how this would play out, but the love of self for God's sake. And I thought this was powerful because the pattern was consistent with what I'll call kind of a variation on a theme. Who does the innovator love and for whose sake? So I'd say that you could draw the same chart for innovators, that everybody kind of on the left of the line is loving for their own sake, and even the ones in the upper left are loving customers because they know if they don't love the customer, they'll probably lose their job, okay? But the people who are the breakthrough innovators, you know, they don't tell you this explicitly, but you hear about it as they describe their work. They live in this right-hand side, and it's pretty powerful to see. So how would you compare these two? I mentioned this earlier, that the serial and breakthrough innovators are self-motivated to solve other people's problems. Love for self's sake doesn't look like that. A powerful passing comment made by one of the innovators was that when he looks to hire people, he hires people that want to do the work that innovators do, not people who want to be an innovator. Oh, to me, that's amazing, because these are the people committed to do what's necessary to do the job, not necessarily viewing themselves as being someone to be viewed as, you know, kind of this elite group within a company. I'd say that the breakthrough innovators tend to show wisdom as opposed to being necessarily driven. And I'm not saying these are not hardworking people, because they are incredibly hardworking people. But they're able to be self-confident but humble. They have high standards. But what's interesting, and I love to use this dichotomy, loving for self's sake tends to be aggressive, while loving for others' sake will be typically described as assertive. There's a tolerance on this side. Not an indefinite tolerance, but a tolerance. These people understand on the right side that there are times when working 80 or 100-hour weeks is necessary, and there are times when it's not. And finally, they understand how to be light-touched in interactions with other people. It's a different kind of love. Insubordination. We would hear about acts of insubordination by these people, but they were insubordination in the best sense. One of the people that we talked to, actually a good friend and colleague of my colleague, Ray Price, this is Chuck House, who had been at Hewlett-Packard for most of his career. Chuck received an award for insubordination above and beyond the call of duty, and he received it because he was told by, and I forget if it was Hewlett or Packard, that the next time he came back to review this work a year from now, I don't want to see this in the lab. And a year from now, it was not in the lab. It was commercialized. It was in a product, okay? And, you know, he was told, you knew what I meant, and, you know, they knew, but they were satisfied because he took appropriate risks. The innovator that I talked about earlier who said, I see dead people, I heard her tell an amazing story. She was told to not work on, she was told to emphasize something else, which she did. She did, and not maliciously compliantly, so amazingly appropriately compliantly, did what she was told to do, but because a lot of these people are so bright and have so much energy and curiosity, she still kept in the background working in these other areas so that when they needed it, it was ready. The posture and practice, and I think I can do this in about 5 minutes. I had been noodling on this for a while when I saw an article by Edmund Phelps, a Nobel Prize winner in economics, in First Things a few years ago, and I thought he made some pretty interesting points. He talked about there's the spirit of challenge and self-discovery that's really part of who we are as humans. He referred to some writing by Augustine on it. And his point was, and this was not unlike what Dr. Ming Wang spoke on Saturday about, that societies that suppress this will stagnate and die. And he felt that morality in economics isn't how you distribute income or how stable of an economic situation you have, but whether your human institutions allow this to take place. And I thought that was pretty powerful. But then I also thought, there's another morality or sense of justice in innovation. And so I wrote a very brief letter in response, a letter to the editor, about what I view as kind of the morality of true innovation. And this is, again, going deeper into what a theology of innovation looks like to me. These people are discoverers, and this is that unity of how this is like any other problem. They discover the best problems, the best solutions. They discover what works for their colleagues, for their investors, for management, and they discover that in this highly constrained, the most successful people are remarkable. I talked earlier about their vision. They transcend these processes. They're not guessing, but they really get it in a powerful way. And they speak with almost like a faith-like expectation that something good will happen. They discern what I will refer to, and I want to be careful because I did not do this as an explicit study of their faith, so the most I can say is that they behave as if they're submitting to a hidden reality. And it's beautiful, as I've said, to hear their stories, and I'll say that you have this sense that they're seeking first the kingdom of God. Now, again, I don't want to cross the line here to say that I know they are in all cases. I've gotten to know some. I know some are believers. But what I'm saying is their behaviors are consistent. They're charged to see what's hidden in plain sight. Most of us are said, you're telling me to innovate? What do you want me to do? You know, it's a familiar pattern in Scripture, both in the Old and New Testament, people being chided almost. You always hear but don't understand. You see but you don't perceive. There's this innovation in plain sight that people often don't see. I'm reminded by, especially with Nebuchadnezzar's dream, his magicians say, tell us your dream and we'll interpret it. And he says, no, you have to tell me the dream. These innovators are the ones that define the problems. Other people will often be given problems. They will redefine the problems. So even in that way, they show characteristics that are similar to what we see in Scripture. There's this familiar posture of knowing. First of all, believing comes before knowing. This knocked me over. I'm sure a lot of you guys are more than aware of this. In modernity, we know in order to believe. In faith, we believe in order to know. But that knowing is like hearing and recognizing a voice or viewing a magic eye image. Are you guys familiar with these children's magic eyes books? This is the pattern that first really came in front of me, and Esther Meek, who I mentioned earlier at Geneva College, uses this example. I wish it were mine, but it's hers, about knowing in general. What I've seen, and I'm almost done, they look at all this massive data, not just the science, not just the physical world. They look at customer needs, the organizational politics, markets, manufacturing, technology, how to finance this. They see it all at once, and just like a magic eyes image, they're staring at it, and all of a sudden, they see the three-dimensional image, if you will. And it's just like viewing an RDS as a random dot stereogram. It's one of these. All the patterns, all the postures are similar. Now let's look at Scripture. These same patterns are in Scripture. Jesus rebukes and chides the Pharisees. You can interpret the weather, but you can't read the signs of the time, okay? You have the ability, if you will, to recognize patterns, but not this pattern. He says, you search the Scriptures diligently, but don't see that they testify to him. It's like looking at this magic eye image and not focusing properly. It's like looking at the dots and never seeing the three-dimensional image. I say that at least this part of it has enough parallel that I think it's powerful. So kind of summarizing this, and then I'll end. The most successful innovators that we interviewed, again, large mature companies, people who have had breakthroughs, they live as though they accept uncertainty and expect serendipity. Like farmers, they plant seeds, they plow, they care for their fields in anticipation and expectation of a harvest. And they seem to accept innovation as a gift that they're given. It's their lot in life, if you will. They recognize that there's only so much that they can, if you will, control. So while innovation remains appropriately unconquered and profoundly unpredictable, you know, my view is that I think that we can understand and accept more by this view. And what I'll do is, I'm going to jump to the very end here. What I'd like to do is end the way Craig Gay ended his book, and that's with 2 Corinthians 12:9-10. You know, my grace is sufficient for you, and when I am weak, and only then am I strong, because it's the power in Christ that rests in me. And I don't want to sound corny, but when the power was out last night, you know, it's the power of Christ in the end that rests on us, that when we can do these things. And so I believe, you know, kind of referring back to the topic of this meeting, that we are given this ability to be creative, but it occurs very often because we're made in God's image to relate with him and to be in relation with him. And it's in this perichoresis, this dance that we have with the triune God, that we can have the ability to innovate and do these things. So I would appreciate any feedback or observations or questions or comments. Yeah.